case of the day, Evans v. Greenfield Banking, 13-3054. Mr. Henning, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, the issues in this case are relatively simple. Can the Evans family bring claims for civil damages caused by a VA appointed federal fiduciary for damages to Mr. Evans? What court, agency, jurisdictional body, forum can the Evans family file these claims against the fiduciary, in this case Greenfield Banking Company, and when can they file those claims against the bank? Now, as of the first issue, the VA Court of Appeals has provided some guidance to the court in the Hardcastle decision regarding whether or not the Evans family can bring claims for civil damages caused by a federal fiduciary to a veteran.
Mr. Henning, before you get to that, what is your underlying cause of action here? There's a little bit of a moving target.
The underlying cause of action against the bank?
Yes.
Three causes of action. They are cause of action for conversion under Indiana state law, claims for breaches of fiduciary duties under Indiana state law, and we had a constructive trust claim in the complaint for regarding any profits or any monies that were unlawfully obtained by the bank as a result of the breaches of fiduciary duties or conversion. Those are the only three causes of action that have been asserted by the Evans family in the state. Originally, the state court filed action, and then it's the same complaint that was then removed to federal court.
Isn't this really just a dispute over the distribution of VA benefits?
It is. The Evans family believes that the bank unlawfully withheld benefits from the veteran, Mr. Evans, and in doing so, violated Indiana state law.
And given that concession, why is this court the appropriate court?
There's no other court. The VA has a separate system set up for disputes regarding the award of benefits and other initial decisions that are made by the VA with respect to whether or not a veteran is entitled to benefits. But that administrative procedure does not have, those courts don't have any, those administrative agencies don't have any stand or jurisdiction to hear claims against the independent fiduciary such as the bank.
How does this differ from your client's case that went up to the Federal Circuit and the claims that they were arguing there?
The only issue in that case was whether or not the VA had violated or unlawfully or improperly removed the former fiduciary, Mrs. Carolyn Stump, Mr. Evans' daughter, who had been taking care of her for a number of years prior to the VA becoming involved. That's the only issue. That administrative proceeding, the Evans family initially sought emergency relief with one of the appellate courts through the VA system. When that was unsuccessful, they appealed the decision to remove Ms. Stump as the fiduciary to the board, and then that case was working its way through the VA system when Mr. Evans passed away in December of 2012. According to the VA Court of Appeals decision in Hardcastle, claims against the fiduciary for breaches of fiduciary duty should be filed in a court of competent jurisdiction. And there's been some arguments in the brief about what does a court of competent jurisdiction mean. We would, as we've set forth in our briefs, but we believe that that means a court, a state or a federal court depending on which has jurisdiction under the rules and the civil procedural guidelines set forth for filing a claim in state or federal court. The VA and the bank, throughout this case, the most frustrating thing is that no matter what court we've been in, it's always been the wrong court. If we're in front of the VA Court of Appeals and in Hardcastle, the same counsel that was representing the Evans family represented Mr. Hardcastle in that case. And when they attempted to bring claims regarding breaches of fiduciary duties against the bank, the VA court said, nope, can't do that here. If you have a fiduciary breach claim, you can bring that case in a court of competent jurisdiction, which is exactly what we've done here. We filed those claims in an Indiana state court, and again, the VA and the bank said, nope, you've got the wrong court. They removed it to federal court. Nope, federal court does not have jurisdiction over these claims. At the end of the day, we're trying to figure out what court, what agency has jurisdiction over these claims. And no matter what court we're in, no matter what administrative agency we're in, it's always not this one. Now, one of the things I'd like to point to, because the primary argument by the VA and the bank is that there's been a failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And they point to a couple of different statutes which we have discussed and addressed in our briefs. But I would like to, if we're going to compare, look at a statute where Congress, the legislature, has provided for an administrative remedy that must be exhausted prior to filing suit. I would direct the court to the Federal Tort Claims Act, 28 U.S.C. Section 2675. Title of that, the FTCA, is Disposition by a Federal Agency as a Prerequisite. And the statute then goes forward to outline a number of prerequisites that must be satisfied before a party can bring their claim in federal court under the Federal Tort Claims Act. The action shall not be instituted upon a claim against the United States for money damages until claimant shall have first presented the claim to the appropriate federal agency. Give the agency an opportunity to review that, then deny it. If it's not denied within a specific period of time as outlined in the statute, then that party has the right to bring their claim in federal court. We don't have any statutes. We don't have any regulations that provide any similar type of process. And I would direct the court to the decision Whitman versus American Trucking Associations. It's a U.S. Supreme Court decision, 531 U.S. 457, that was cited by this court in Rodas versus Seidlin, where, quote, Congress, we have held, does not alter the fundamental details of a regulatory scheme in vague terms or ancillary provisions. It does not, one might say, hide elephants in mouse holes. That's what we have here with the bank and with the VA. They're attempting to find and create administrative remedies that administrative regulations that do not exist. With that, having no other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hinnan. Ms. Julian?
May it please the court, Jill Julian with the United States Attorney's Office on behalf of the Secretary. Your Honors, Carolyn Stump filed this action in state court because she wanted to regain control over her father's veterans benefits after she was removed as the fiduciary. The appellant's complaint filed in state court is a chronicle of the Evans family disagreement with the decisions made by the Secretary regarding her removal, the appointment of the bank, and the decisions by the Secretary in regard to the manner in which the Secretary supervised the bank. As this complaint is drafted, judicial review of the action that the appellants themselves have pled is precluded by 38 United States Code Section 511. By Section 511, Congress made clear that it is the Secretary that decides all questions of law and fact necessary to a decision by the Secretary under a law that affects the provision of benefits by the Secretary to a veteran.
You seem to be arguing for a narrow decision. Are there some Are there some situations where a breach of fiduciary obligation case could be brought in the state court?
Your Honor, exactly, yes, Your Honor. Not pled in this case. The Secretary is not arguing that a breach of fiduciary action could never be brought against a VA-appointed fiduciary. But the appellants are the masters of their own litigation strategy. They are the architects of their complaint. And by the complaint that's before the court, they are alleging that by following the fiduciary agreement that they entered with the bank, with the VA, they breached a corresponding fiduciary duty under Indiana law. For any court to find liability based on that claim, it would be necessary to review the decisions of the Secretary, the policies of the Secretary, the correspondence between the Secretary and the bank. That is precisely the type of action that is precluded under Section 511. What they have not alleged is, absent the VA scheme, absent Section 5502 and the discretion of the Secretary, that the bank breached a fiduciary responsibility to Mr. Evans. Each and every one of the allegations of their complaint is founded upon the notion that the bank followed the rules that the VA gave them, and as a result, under Indiana law, they breached a duty to Mr. Evans.
Which brings us, I think, to your brother's comments about the elephant in the mouse hole. If I have an FTCA case, I have a Social Security case, I have an immigration case, and I know it's set forth in the law and the regulations precisely when I can go to the board with the case, when I've got the decision of the Secretary that's reviewable by the board. I don't see that in your brief. There does not seem to be an administrative structure here where the Secretary says, this is the way I look at things, and the litigant knows it's time to go to the board and begin the review process.
First, Your Honor, Section 511 and the preclusive effect of that does not depend on there actually being another remedy in the precise manner in which the litigant wants that remedy to occur. Understand that the appellants are looking for a remedy. What in I believe they said in their reply brief, in whatever court they could find to take review of that narrow issue of whether or not liability can be imposed on the facts of this complaint. As I indicated, they have not pled a cause of action that does not implicate decision making of the Secretary. And I might refer the court to the Ninth Circuit decision of Veterans Common Sense that's cited in the brief. And in that case, it was a similar situation. And as the court looked at the complaint, the Ninth Circuit acknowledged that if decisions of the Secretary under 511 were implicated, it would have no jurisdiction. And then the court went on to say, but the litigants have carefully crafted their complaint to avoid the application of Section 511. And the court exercised jurisdiction over some of the allegations that were raised because they were a facial attack on the statute.
On the allegations that have been made here, is it your view that there is a remedy, an administrative remedy, that can be exhausted?
Not for damages as they have pled it, Your Honor. And it may be that had they pled this differently from the get-go, that they may not have pled themselves out of or into Section 511 review. But they are the architects of their complaint. In fact, if you look at the complaint, in particular paragraphs 19 and 20 of the complaint, and compare that with the fiduciary agreement, which is also in the supplemental appendix at page 38, paragraphs 19 and 20 of the complaint make clear that they're alleging that the bank has an actual and direct conflict of interest between the VA and its duty to Mr. Evans because it must obtain approval before any disbursement of $1,000 or it must retain at least $800 as savings for Mr. Evans. And then paragraph 20 talks about the statutory fee of 4%. If you look at the fiduciary agreement, those are provisions in the agreement with the VA. So those are terms dictated by the VA. They're asking the state court to review whether or not following that agreement subjects the bank to liability. And that is what the Secretary believes is within 511.
Could appellants have brought this complaint before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and had it survived there?
As drafted?
As drafted.
I don't believe so as drafted. However, there's nothing in the record to indicate. There's also a regulatory provision. It's in Part 13. It's 38 CFR 13.100 that talks about if there's an allegation of misuse by a fiduciary, it goes to the VA Regional Council, who may then make the review through the regulatory process. Now, that may not allow a claim for damages in favor of the veteran, but it does provide a mechanism to take a review of the claim as far as the misuse of funds allegation is concerned. And then moving forward, Your Honors, in 38 United States Code section, I believe it's 6101 through 6107 or 8, there's a mechanism by which there is some provision for if the VA itself was negligent in its supervision of a fiduciary, which actually then might cause a loss of funds to the veteran, that the VA would restore those benefits. Now, that process didn't get to that point in this case, but in all instances, the statutory scheme does allow the secretary to make the decisions in the best interest of the veteran and provides a, if you will, safety net to make sure that the veteran's benefits go to where they should go.
What type of breach of fiduciary claim do you think appellant could have brought in either state or federal court?
Hypothetically, Your Honor, it may be that a claim, if they simply alleged that a bank was appointed a fiduciary and the bank manager took $5,000 of the veteran's money, bought a car for himself, and the bank manager was driving that car around town, that doesn't appear on its face to implicate a decision by the secretary. It doesn't implicate VA decision-making. The complaint in this case simply did not narrowly tailor those claims. And for those reasons, Your Honor, I ask that you affirm the decision of the district court dismissing the action for lack of jurisdiction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
May it please the court. Andrew Miller on behalf of Greenfield Banking Company and Joanna Springmeier. At its root, all of the appellant's claims against the bank all revolve around the bank having followed the procedures established by the VA for the federal fiduciary claim. And in honoring the VA's requirements, disregarding the requests of the appellants as to the distribution of funds. And appellants claim that that then subjects the bank to liability for breaches of fiduciary duty, for conversion, and for a constructive trust. But all of those claims revolve around the fact that the bank was not distributing money as requested by the appellants. Rather, they were following the procedures. An example being that the secretary touched on was withholding $800 a month in order to build up a fund for extraordinary expenses, for consulting the VA for expenditures in excess of $1,000, for following the procedure requiring original receipts rather than copies. That original receipt requirement was imposed because of the VA's finding that the prior federal fiduciary had misappropriated in excess of $20,000 of funds. So in following those VA-imposed regulations upon the bank, appellants would suggest that that then imposes the bank and Ms. Springmeier to liability for breaches of fiduciary duty, for conversion, and for a constructive trust. The district court recognized that the appellant's claims address Greenfield's management of VA benefits, which implicates the secretary's authority to supervise fiduciaries. And the secretary does exercise that supervisory role over federal fiduciaries. As a matter of fact, the secretary exercised that supervisory role over the predecessor federal fiduciary in requiring regular accountings. And those regular accountings were not timely made, resulting in a removal of that prior fiduciary.
Your basic position is, look, we're good soldiers. Secretary tells us how we should act as the fiduciary. We came to attention and saluted, and we did exactly what the secretary told us. What the veterans are really doing is saying the secretary is wrong. Secretary misinterpreted the statute, but it's not your problem.
Judge Ripple, that's exactly what we're saying.
Okay. Now, this is what I was trying to get from the government. If that is, in fact, what the Evans are alleging, do they have any administrative remedy? Is there any process they can follow to say the secretary is wrong in telling the bank it can take this it can take this commission, it can do this, it can do that? The secretary's dead wrong.
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
And how would that work?
That procedure, as outlined in the Evans, the district court's opinion, as well as Olson, if the ward has questions, has complaints regarding whether it be a breach of fiduciary duty, conversion, whatever it may be, that then would be submitted to the VA, where the VA Office of Inspector General would then investigate those claims. If there is an actionable claim, then it would be turned over to the U.S. Attorney's Office, who could then proceed with that claim before the Board of Veterans Appeals. The Board of Veterans Appeals opinion could then be appealed before the Court of Appeals for Veterans Appeals.
Now, why the Inspector General? The Inspector General's job, as I understand it, is to look for misfeasance on the part of government officers and employees within the agency.
Your Honor, that is the procedure that was outlined and as recognized by the Olson opinion.
Yeah, I know that, but I got to decide this myself.
Well, I think,
that's right.
I think that that's broadly speaking, the Office of Inspector General is absolutely the appropriate place because these are VA administered funds.
Now, your sister just suggested to us, albeit obliquely, and as a second thought, that there is apparently some kind of regulation by which you go to a regional director, and that regional director has a crack at this, and then it goes to the then you get a so-called, I guess, agency decision that you can take to the board.
Correct.
Now, what is it? Regional director, or is it the inspector general?
The regional director is the one that appoints the federal fiduciary and conducts the first level of kind of investigation. For instance,
now we come back to your brother's question. He says, you know, there's an elephant in the hole here. In any other federal agency, there is, in fact, an administrative procedure spelled out in statute and regulations. Here, there's nothing.
Well, Your Honor, yeah.
It looks like if you guys are right, the Veterans Administration has sat there on its hands and has put together nothing, no roadmap by which a litigant can get an adjudication of these matters.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. And if there is this the most artfully drafted legislation ever? Probably not. Probably not, to be fair, but there are avenues of redress. And if the court would look at the opinions that the Veterans Appeals, the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, these same claims have been brought. For instance, in one, the petitioners, the appellants, were seeking an order declaring that the Secretary's disregard of the powers granted in the executed durable power of attorney and associated property rights of the attorney, in fact, violate the laws of the state of Indiana. That's exactly what we have here, Your Honors, is that the appellants are saying, well, GBC, Greenfield Bank, and the veteran VA in appointing GBC trampled over the rights of the Indiana-appointed guardian. Those claims, that's the violation of Indiana state law that's being referred to in that opinion. There is meaningful redress. I see that my time has expired. If there's no other questions, I would urge the judges affirm the district court's order.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Miller. How much time? 7 minutes, Mr. Henning.
Just a few brief points, Your Honor. One of the questions that was asked was whether or not are there certain breaches that can be filed in state court? Are there breaches of fiduciary duty that are bad enough then? So if the bank lights Mr. Evans's money on fire, I presume that would be a breach of their fiduciary duties and they should be allowed to pursue that claim in a state court. They attack the complaint as not being specific enough or as having some vague issues or questions in the factual allegations.
I think it's a little different than that. They are challenging the complaint and saying it doesn't provide a basis for jurisdiction here because all of your claims are grounded in the agreements that the bank had with the VA. And do you concede that, I guess, is the first question. Do you agree
I agree that's
your,
their argument.
Do you agree that your complaint bases the breach of fiduciary duty arguments on the bank's agreement with the VA and the procedures established by the VA?
Not at all. Not at all.
Can you point to something in the complaint that your fiduciary duty is based on something else?
Yes. We cited specifically the Indiana causes of action, Indiana statutes for conversion.
Not the statutes, but the underlying factual allegations forming the basis of your fiduciary duty.
Yes, the refusal to reimburse the Evans family for expenses. And again, that's also an issue that should be raised not in a motion to dismiss, but possibly in a motion for summary judgment, but there are only notice pleading requirements under Indiana state law, and our complaint, we believe, satisfied the notice pleading requirements. One of the other things that the Secretary has argued is that the claims are based or grounded somehow in decisions being made by the VA, by the Secretary, as opposed to the bank. That contradicts all of the established record evidence indicating that the bank is supposed to be an independent fiduciary. They're required by law to be independent from the Secretary. They are required to make decisions based on their own independent knowledge and expertise as a fiduciary. That's the whole basis for the fiduciary program. Is the VA retains these other federal fiduciaries because they have experience in handling these kinds of issues. We have evidence from the director of the VA Pension and Benefits Program, Director McClenahan. We have emails from the VA, all of which are in the briefs and in the record, establishing that the bank makes these decisions. Not the VA, not the Secretary. It is the bank that makes these decisions. Our arguments, our legal causes of action are not based on assuming that we can rely upon the evidence and the statements from these executives and employees with the VA. They're not based on any actions taken by the VA. If they are, that raises a whole host of other questions and issues. But based on the record and what we have on the motion to dismiss, all of the evidence establishes that the bank is supposed to be completely independent. The only other thing
but
I'd like
to... But aren't the allegations, so they're not based on actions by the VA, aren't the allegations based on agreements with the VA and procedures of the VA that the bank was following?
The bank may try to raise that as a defense, but our understanding, again, is that the claims are based on breaches of Indiana state law resulting from the bank's actions. If the bank is relying upon a fiduciary agreement or some other document to argue that the Evans family is precluded, then, again, as we raised in our brief, we believe that's a preemption defense. What they're really arguing is that by complying with federal law, we cannot be held liable under any Indiana or other state law. Now, the bank and the VA both very clearly state they are not making a preemption defense, but that's exactly what that argument is. By saying that we complied with federal law and with federal regulations, we cannot be held liable under any Indiana state law. that's their argument. We believe it would be at least appropriate to remand it to the district court for further development of the factual record. But we believe that based on the other merits, the case should be reversed and sent back to the district court for further proceedings.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement. I'll call the third.